number four. United States versus Rodney Henderson.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Heather Winslow. I represent Rodney Henderson, the appellant in this matter. I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Unless the panel has specific questions about that issue, I would rest on the briefs as to the pre-indictment delay question and focus specifically on the district court's erroneous admission of irrelevant testimony about the government informant's cooperation in other unrelated cases. The district court's error was substantially prejudicial to Mr. Henderson, and for this reason we ask that this court reverse the judgment below and remand for a new trial. The informant's cooperation in other cases was irrelevant to his motive to falsify a deal with Mr. Henderson. The cooperation in each of those cases occurred after his cooperation against Mr. Henderson. Nonetheless, the government argues that the informant at the time he cooperated against Mr. Henderson had some expectation of a future benefit, hoped, in fact, to cooperate against other individuals in the future and therefore to get some kind of benefit from that.
Isn't it true that even at the time this buy occurs with Mr. Henderson, Mr. McFaul had already passed information along to the government about other people?
Your Honor, he had made statements. We have no information on the record as to whether those statements were ever even corroborated. He simply met with government agents, given them some certain information. But that is not the kind of cooperation that will net him a tangible benefit in negotiating his own plea agreement. In fact, at all times relevant to this case, Mr. McFaul had no other substantial cooperation or substantial participation in other cases which would have improved his plea bargaining position.
But he doesn't actually wind up doing the plea bargains until years later. And it sounds like the rule you're arguing for is the first few somehow don't count, only the later ones do.
Your Honor, the question in this case is whether the government's informant, Mr. McFaul, had a motive to fabricate the deal at the time he cooperated against Mr. Henderson. For that reason, the order of these other cooperation events is extremely important. At the time he cooperated against Mr. Henderson, he had no other, as the Seventh Circuit has phrased it, bargaining chip with which to negotiate a beneficial plea agreement. This, to the best of his knowledge at that time, was it. In addition, this court
only had if he wanted it to be it. This was entirely in his control, wasn't it? If he wanted to be very helpful to government, he could do case two, case three, case N. If he wanted this to be the only thing he brought to the table, he could do this. But Mr. Henderson wasn't that big of a dealer.
That was Mr. McFaul's hope, according to the government, that he would be able to cooperate against other individuals in the future. But Mr. McFaul had a secondary motive to falsify a deal at this time. At all times relevant to his cooperation against Mr. Henderson, he was continuing to deal drugs on his own. So in addition to needing to make some cooperation efforts for the government, he had the additional motive of wanting to falsify those cooperation efforts in order to not burn his own drug buyers and drug sellers, his supply and demand, if you will. So the question of McFaul's motive to testify falsely at the time of Mr. Henderson's trial is irrelevant. He did not testify at Mr. Henderson's trial.
Right. I wonder if you could just quickly jump over to harmless error, because one of the things the government has also argued is that Mr. McFaul didn't even know that this particular transaction was going to take place at the What's Up barbershop, you know, on the day until a very, very short period of time before that. And he really, frankly, just wouldn't have had the time to do the kinds of things Mr. Henderson is speculating he might have tried to do.
Well, Your Honor, there are several points in the record which actually raise more questions about that. Initially, Mr. Henderson worked at the What's Up barbershop every day. So if there was any opportunity for this deal to be done during the day, it would occur at Mr. Henderson's place of employment. That's where he was found every day. In addition, Mr. McFaul was not in custody during any of this period of time. his phone calls, other than those specific phone calls recorded by the government, his phone calls were a mystery. We don't know whether or how often he called Mr. Henderson on any other day. And in our motion to dismiss the indictment for pre-indictment delay, we specifically raised with Judge Cannelli the question of getting these phone records. By the time we subpoenaed these phone records in 2002, the phone company had long since destroyed them. So we don't have any way of knowing whether Mr. McFaul was calling Mr. Henderson on a daily basis, whether or not he would have been able to say, Rodney, will you be working on this particular day, in order to make his arrangements accordingly. So for that reason, among others, this error, that particular portion of the error, is not harmless. In fact, the error substantially prejudiced Mr. Henderson. This court has often recognized this kind of evidence, this kind of bolstering evidence, is admitted only with very great care. Good conduct evidence is admitted with great care because it may cause the jury to overlook discrepancies or inconsistencies in the government's case. In this matter, the jury had to make a decision about what occurred during the period of time that Mr. McFaul was out of government surveillance.
Don't the tapes also, though, suggest, again, maybe this is partly a harmless error point, but partly that there was some evidence before the jury that they had arranged a deal that Mr. Henderson was committing to give him a certain amount of drugs for a certain price, and I mean that the idea that this was all Mr. McFaul setting it up is quite inconsistent with that evidence.
The evidence, Your Honor, is not quite that specific. The evidence is somewhat cryptic phone calls back and forth between these two individuals. At no point does Mr. Henderson ever say, I will supply you with these drugs.
Well, they never do. I mean, they talk in these kind of codes.
In drug code.
Well, I think that's entirely relevant in this case, though. The government has charged Mr. Henderson with delivery of this quantity of crack cocaine, and yet all it can prove is that he had a conversation about some quantity of crack cocaine. Those are entirely different charges. One that could be known as a telephone charge. It has not proved, and it is the government's burden to prove, that Mr. Henderson was the source of those drugs. In light of the gaps in surveillance and the period of time in which McFaul was out of government surveillance, we cannot prove that. Mr. McFaul, as the tapes also reveal, purposely took himself out of any area of surveillance when he went into the barbershop bathroom. He was behind closed doors, he was by himself, no one could observe him or his actions during this period of time. Again, taking that with the question of whether he had a motive to fabricate a deal, that being protecting his own drug suppliers, it's entirely reasonable that he would have created phone conversations that would suggest that Mr. Henderson would be the source of the drugs. Those phone conversations were equally consistent with Mr. Henderson simply providing information about cost of drugs or some other related issue. Those phone conversations never clearly state that Mr. Henderson would be the source of those drugs. In light of Mr. McFaul's clear motive to fabricate a deal, and in light of the gaps in surveillance, this kind of bolstering and irrelevant evidence about Mr. McFaul's other cooperation, which occurred after this case, was substantially prejudicial, and the error cannot be harmless. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, good morning, judges. Brian Havey on behalf of the United States. Your Honor, these arguments that defense counsel is making to you were made to the district judge. He carefully considered these arguments and he ruled against them twice. He ruled prior to trial, he allowed them to renew, he ruled in a post-trial motion, and both times he ruled against them, and I submit that his decision was not that hard to make. And even when the issue was first raised, the first time in a pretrial conference, even defense counsel's initial reaction, and it's in the transcript, was, this sounds reasonable to us too, what the government is proposing. This evidentiary issue is a situation where the defense is telling the judge, we're going to be admitting this evidence. The government now, so the question is, can the government respond with their own evidence, its version of what happened? Why can't the jury hear that? The defense is saying Mr. Motive, Mr. McFaul had the motive and intent to plant drugs. We say he didn't. Here's why. And what happened before the drug deal and after the drug deal is as relevant as anything else. And I would bet my last dollar, Judge, that if this situation was reversed and Mr. McFaul had failed miserably after this Henderson deal, couldn't make a single case, made the Henderson case and nothing else after it, I bet my last dollar they'd be arguing to the district judge that that evidence should be allowed.
Sure, that's not a...
I'm sorry.
I won't bet against you on that. But you're supposed to raise those issues. All she's doing is raising an issue which should be raised.
Yes, Judge, I agree with that. That's fair. But what all we're saying is they can't have it both ways. They want to admit their evidence and say, well, the government shouldn't be allowed to respond to this. We're entitled to a fair trial, too, Your Honor. All we're saying is don't tie our hands.
All she said is that the Confrontation Clause is being disturbed by what you did. There's a difference.
I don't believe that this is a confrontation issue, Judge.
Well, it depends on how you look at it, I suppose.
They're claiming he had a motive to plant drugs, and they want to put evidence into the record on that.
And they're also taking what I'd call an ex-ante approach. They're saying, as of the time of this transaction, Mr. McFaul, for all he knew, was going to either make it or break it on the Henderson case, and so he might have had every reason to show what a great guy he was, you know, how he could deliver the defendant, and the future was still in the future then. Nobody knew, and so why wouldn't he have... And why is the future relevant as of the time he actually deals with Henderson?
Well, that's true, Judge, but that's an argument to the jury. I mean, we're arguing about weight issues here and what inferences you can draw from the evidence. All we're saying is allow us to present our version. And our version is, as you pointed out, he had already provided information to the government. It wasn't someday. We gave them the reports. He provided information about 20 different people, and he intended to work cases on that because he was facing a huge jail sentence. He didn't want to start and end this thing with Rodney Henderson, frankly, because he had bigger fish to fry. And he worked with the government, and he made cases, and he knew he could make cases at the time he did this deal, and that's proven by this evidence of other defendants pleading guilty. Now, they're worried about an inference that can be drawn improperly by the jury, by these guilty pleas? Fine. The government tendered a limiting instruction. That limiting instruction was given. We did not harp on this evidence at trial. It came out, we dropped it. We didn't even go back to it again. Judge, this was a blip on the screen, and as you pointed out, this whole harmless error argument, these transcripts were not as ambiguous as defense counsel would say. And there was no question about who is setting up where this is going to happen. McFaul asked him, where are we going to do this? He doesn't say, well, how about if we do it at the barbershop? He says, where? And Rodney Henderson says, come to North Chicago, come to the barbershop. This notion that McFaul would have gone there a day ahead of time and planted the dope, hoping it would go there is preposterous. Rodney Henderson could have picked any place to do the deal. He could have changed the location. What's McFaul going to do then? Somebody could have found the drugs. He doesn't know ahead of time where agents are going to be. He's risking everything by planting drugs there. Somebody could walk into the bathroom and find the drugs. So I think this argument they're making, Your Honor, is really inconsistent with the tapes. The day before, they talked price and quantity. 4.5. He says hard. That means crack. How much? 25. $2,500. Lo and behold, what happens? 4.5 ounces for $2,500. There's no other explanation. Granted, they don't have to prove that. That's their right. All we're saying is the jury made that determination. We should have been allowed to admit the evidence. The judge recognized that. He made the correct decision. That decision was not an abuse of discretion. So, Judge, for that reason and the other reasons in the brief and on the issue, I won't address the pre-indictment delay unless you have questions. We would request that you affirm the decision of the district court.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
How much time? 2 minutes, sir.
Thank you. First, I'd like to address the statement in the record in which co-counsel stated that the judge's solution to the matter sounds reasonable. As the entire record shows, that was taken somewhat out of context in a pre-trial conference in which we were exploring these issues. We then raised them again and specifically re-argued this issue to Judge Cannelli, in which we again objected to the admission of this testimony. The government has argued that Mr. Henderson essentially opened the door to this testimony about Mr. McFaul's other cooperation with the defense that he chose to present. Mr. Henderson opened the door to relevant testimony about that would rebut his argument that Mr. McFaul had a motive to fabricate the deal against him, not to irrelevant testimony such as this. Irrelevant testimony about something that occurred later on in time that Mr. McFaul could have nothing but an unrealized expectation of at the time he cooperated against Mr. Henderson. In addition, the government raises the issue of the court's limiting instruction. That limiting instruction stated to the jury only that they could not infer Mr. Henderson's guilt from the fact of the prior of the guilty pleas which occurred after this case. Nonetheless, the jury was still left with this irrelevant evidence about McFaul's cooperation in other later cases to fill the gaps in the government's surveillance, to fill the gaps in the government's case.
So wasn't the jury entitled to decide whether it wanted to believe Mr. McFaul? I mean, this evidence in the end just says, you know, maybe he wasn't badly motivated after all, or setting it up, and the jury could decide.
In fact, it leaves the jury with only that evidence, because it wasn't able to observe his testimonial demeanor, it leaves the jury with only that evidence with which to make a decision about whether the government's, about the integrity of the government's investigation, about whether they could believe Mr. McFaul. In light of all the factors in this case, that's not sufficient.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. Case number 5.